This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And democracy in America is our focus at the beginning of the hour, a democracy that doesn't look terribly pretty when you look closely at the details. We'll talk about that in a moment. We're also going to talk about how viruses can change nations, economies, and make it hard for those nations to recover, even if the virus is gone. Stigma remains, and it has an economic cost. We'll look at that this hour. Also, Ben Bradley, Boston Brahmin, tough independent warrior, Washington luminary, a man who lived the changes in Washington, D.C. for all of his career as editor and reporter for Newsweek and then editor of The Washington Post. He changed the world as that paper's editor. We will remember a legend, gone at the age of 93. But we begin with bad news for judges facing elections in America today. In the Citizens United era, a judge may be tempted to avoid leniency in a criminal defendant to avoid a campaign ad accusing that judge of being soft on crime. Is this democracy? Bert Brandenburg, executive director of Justice at Stake, doesn't like it at all. He said this on The Takeaway this year.
We give our judges a different assignment. The Constitution tells our judges, you're supposed to decide cases one at a time based on the facts and the law, not based on political pressure, not based on campaign ads, not based on campaign money you may have raised. And even more chilling is that the judges who are now trapped in the system, when they go out to raise the money, the people they go to are the parties who then appear before them.
And here's former Iowa State Supreme Court Justice David Baker.
I have a problem with this. I mean, aside from this fundraising aspect, there's going to be the perception by those using the courts that the court system is not fair and impartial.
Should judges have to raise money for their own elections? Should judges' elections be subject to traditional campaign finance laws where, in the Citizens United era, huge amounts of money can be spent to bring down sitting judges who might never have been noticed on the ballot before? Our next guest, Carolyn Fredrickson, president of the National Constitution Society, has been studying this. Carolyn, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's take a look at how you've studied this. You've looked broadly, and you've also looked at some of the tactics. First, broadly, how many judges are being affected by this phenomenon?
Well, we have campaigns that go on in the vast majority of our states. In fact, well, we looked at 32 states in the case of our most recent study, which was looking at the influence of campaign advertising. In this particular instance, we looked at how ads using criminal cases as a framework affected how judges voted subsequently on cases in front of them that concerned violent crimes, rape, murder, aggravated assault, and so forth. And, you know, the basic fact was that the judges are influenced. And, you know, this is distressing because, you know, obviously we want our judges to be impartial. And the clip you used from Bert Brandenburg is exactly right. We expect judges to be different. We expect them to be above the fray, neutral parties, you know, the scales of justice, you know, justice is blind. But in fact, justice in this case has her hand out and is taking money from the parties in front of her. And the campaign ads that she hears are influencing which side of the scale is up and which is down.
Can you document a case where a defendant received a sentence that was far more harsh because perhaps the judge didn't want a lenient sentence to appear in a campaign commercial?
Well, I'll tell you how it works. We looked at more in the aggregate. But if you have, say, a case where 10,000 TV spots aired, and this is not unusual, 10,000. I mean, this is how campaigns have changed. In those cases, justices overall are 11% more likely to vote against a defendant than a justice in a state with no TV ads. 11% is a big swing. And we looked at also the change after Citizens United. Before Citizens United, you know, there were many of the states had a ban on this kind of independent expenditures. And these are, you know, these are independent groups that are running these ads. Usually they don't care that much about crime, but it's a good foil or a proxy for the other issue that they care about. But after Citizens United, when the bans were lifted, and in those states that had not before had this kind of advertising, we've already seen a 7% change, a 7% increase in the justices at the state Supreme Court level voting against criminal defendants. And, you know, I say this because, you know, this is sort of our most fundamental right. When this, you know, the state is against you, you have the right to be tried fairly. And yet we see that these judges are afraid of what's going to happen if they're somehow seen as soft on crime, and they can envision the ad now. And, you know, there's a good example, which is, you know, better known than most because it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. There's a case called Caperton. And in that case, there was a coal company owner named Don Blankenship who in West Virginia, he wanted to change the majority on the state Supreme Court because he'd had a large damage award against his company and he wanted to reverse that. And so he founded a group. It was called And For the Sake of the Kids. I mean, it's so cynical. But he put millions of dollars into it, and he ran ads accusing the justice he wanted off the court of letting a child molester out of jail. But the ad is, you know, is chilling because you see how these issues are used to pressure justices, not just in the criminal justice cases, although that's what we looked at in this study. But it pressures them in all the different cases. It's a way of keeping them in line on political issues that undermines the administration of justice in this country.
Well, here's an ad which was not admissible in court, but based on the way campaigns are conducted in the state of West Virginia, it certainly could easily have been in the minds of jurors and certainly in the mind of the judge here. Listen.
Supreme Court Justice Warren McGraw voted to release child rapist Tony Arbaugh from prison. Worse, McGraw agreed to let this convicted child rapist work as a janitor in a West Virginia school. Warren McGraw, too soft on crime, too dangerous for our kids.
That's the one, right?
Right, that's the one. Yeah. And you see how well disguised the issue is, which is really about Don Blankenship, you know, wanting to keep the money in his own pocket when he owed money in this big damage award against his company. And so he takes it out on this judge, and he makes this, you know, this sensationalistic attack ad about something totally different.
I'm wondering if any of this is challengeable. I mean, the judgeship elections were obscure because people just didn't pay a lot of attention to what's going on here. But, you know, that's not any sort of constitutional question. The fact that suddenly people are paying attention, suddenly ads are focused on individual candidates— there's nothing necessarily illegal about all of that.
Well, this is true. Although even our U.S. Supreme Court, even with Citizens United, has been more protective of state judges than it is of politicians in terms of campaign finance reform. So there's a potential that they see it differently. But there are other ways of choosing judges. And, you know, we're rather anomalous in the world that we elect judges. It's not something that I think there's any other country in the world that does. But I've talked to too many lawyers and too many judges who describe how unseemly it is that, you know, one day the judge is at a law firm and there's a fundraiser at the law firm and all the lawyers give money to the judge. And the next day those lawyers are back in the courtroom in front of that same judge. And one would like to think they're not influenced by it, but you suspect, of course, that they are. And certainly the appearance of corruption is so strong that it undermines the people's trust and belief in our justice system.
Well, nothing will change until a state-by-state initiative actually gets rid of these electoral cases in the selection of judges. Carolyn Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So campaign money is distorting democracy in America. We know that. Let's look once again at Ebola, where a virus is distorting the economies of West Africa. The disease is realigning the region of West Africa. Even if the epidemic was eradicated tomorrow, the impact on Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia would still be permanent. Unplanted crops, unmaintained water and irrigation systems, and villages decimated, disrupting transportation and communication networks. In addition, development projects have been stalled and international trade has been curtailed, and the persistent stigma of Ebola in these countries makes that trade hard to resume in the best of circumstances. It all adds up to a very serious problem in West Africa. And joining me now to explain and to report on the documentation of that problem is Francisco Ferreira, who's the World Bank's chief economist for Africa. Francisco, thanks for joining us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So let's look at the GDP numbers, which are pretty stark. Long-term impact of this Ebola crisis, even just right now, looking right now, is something on the order of 12% decline?
Well, you know, numbers vary. The 12% number, I think, that you're citing is for 2015. What we're looking at for 2014, our estimates are for Guinea 2%, for Sierra Leone 3.3%, for Liberia 3.4% of GDP. Now, it's important to note that those are for the whole year. So, since the epidemic only started in the second half of the year, and it's particularly severe now in the last quarter of the year, the declines right now are probably larger. But for the year as a whole, they'll reduce growth by the order of 3 to 3.4% of GDP in the most affected countries.
And what kinds of things are we talking about? Obviously, it's manufacturing and economic output from agriculture is being affected. Can you itemize a list of things that are most affected in the economies of these countries?
Yeah, what we have data on exactly is things like the fuel sales, so sales of diesel and petrol, which in Sierra Leone are down by a quarter. Sales of cement, which is a good leading indicator of construction, which is also down very substantially in both Liberia and Sierra Leone. We have information on sales of soda and other consumer items, which are also down very substantially. So what it all points to is, as you were saying in your introduction, the result of fear and people's aversion behavior towards the disease, which is shutting down places of employment, reducing people's willingness to go out and spend what little money they have. So there's just a general retraction of the economy across sectors. Tourism, of course, tremendously impacted. No one wants to fly there. Mining, which is a very important sector for these countries. Output declines are relatively low at the moment, but there's a lot of investment put on hold. And so this will impact growth next year, which is in part why the numbers for next year are much more severe.
Finally, before we go, has the World Bank had to postpone or curtail any of its own investments in these nations?
No, on the contrary, we've actually accelerated our investments in response to the need. So we've pledged an additional $400 million to the three countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, which is being spent primarily on the immediate response to the epidemic, on building hospitals, on paying for healthcare workers, and on providing equipment for them. Because the most important investment you could have now is on health.
Well, we're grateful to hear that because so many of the governments are stymied in inaction and indecision as a result of all of this. Francisco Fajera is the World Bank's chief economist for Africa. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The economic impact of Ebola on The Takeaway. Actor Jason Schwartzman was having quite the musical movie date moment with our own Kristen Meinzer the other day.
Is that the sound of your dreams?
Yeah. This is it.
You're dreaming about walking through a forest.
And the forest is made of...
They look like sea monsters, but they're actually magical leaves.
And they're referred to as...
Pumpkin men.
By the local...
People who carry pitchforks.
When he did finally wake up and that improvised dream sequence ran for more than 3 minutes, he got down to the business of talking about his new movie, Listen Up, Philip, where he plays an abrasive, self-loathing novelist who berates a student who comes into his office to just ask for a letter of recommendation.
Look, I'll say this and then we can proceed accordingly. Number one, internships are a waste of time, so you shouldn't bother. Two, that company sucks and you wouldn't gain any worthwhile experience there. And three, I don't actually think that I know you very well. Or at all, now that I think about it. So I wouldn't be the best person to sing your praises. Where does that leave us on the whole letter of recommendation tip?
I think they can be somewhat generic. It's kind of a formality anyway.
Nah.
No pumpkin monsters here, just snarky Jason in a tortured relationship with his girlfriend, played by Elizabeth Moss.
I think it's funny because most movies, so much of it is like the journey of someone trying to find themselves or... learn something. But this guy basically, or at least thinks he's pretty positive he knows who he is. and doesn't care to learn anything because he knows everything, he thinks. And that was fun to do.
You haven't ever played anyone this awful before.
Mm-mm.
And a lot of people probably know you best for all your Wes Anderson roles,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
like Fantastic Mr. Fox, Grand Budapest Hotel, Rushmore, obviously. How is working with Wes Anderson from your very first movie, Rushmore, mm-hmm. on, how has that shaped you and how you act?
Well, completely shaped me, completely. Before I met Wes, I wasn't acting. I was just, you know, a guy in high school in a band. And he gave me my first role and changed my life. And I started to become an actor. He's so funny to me that it can't help but shape who I am.
Well, I have a dream, and I don't know if this dream will ever come true, but I would love it. I have a dream that you're actually going to be a big musical star at some point where
really?
You're going to have a bunch of musicals that come out. Have you
wow.
ever thought about that?
My mom has always said, you should, because my mom is like a musical person. I mean, she just, and growing up, we just listened to musicals all the time and watched musicals, and she has I'll brag on her behalf, like an almost encyclopedic musical database in her brain, and she can just sing so many pieces of music. I don't see myself doing one in that way because I never like sang, and I just, it's not something I feel very comfortable doing. I sing on the records, but you know, it's like you double track your voice, there's no one watching you, you can take your time, you can be off. A musical, like, remember they did when they did Les Mis, the Oscar,
film.
Yeah, and yeah. They sang at the Oscars live. I was watching it, going like, "Oh my god, this is incredible!" I mean, it's incredible to be able to do that, and that's something I wish I could do that.
I believe in you.
Well, I thank you so much. Maybe there's like a perfect musical we could find. It's like about someone who's afraid to do a musical.
Oh, it's going to be a groundbreaker.
Oh, good. I'm happy to break ground.
Jason Schwartzman, thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thank you.
This is so fun.
It was so fun.
I appreciate it.
Jason Schwartzman is the star of the new movie Listen Up, Philip, and you can go to our website at thetakeaway.org to hear the complete dream sequence, Jason, Kristen, and the Pumpkin People. Now, in a world of turmoil back in the 1990s, you could always find a sympathetic ear if you were a child or young adult of the 90s. Dr. Katz was your friendly, animated face you could count on.
So you never, you weren't part of a group of friends at college?
College was tough. I used to wear an earring when I was in college. You know, not a pierced one, a clip-on. One of my mother's big pearl ones.
Yeah, you would accessorize.
Yeah.
Well, which came first, Bill, the earring or the loneliness? I mean, do you think that kept people at a distance?
Well, I was always shy around women, you know, in mm-hmm. high school and college. I mean, today, you know, they call that stalking, but I was shy.
That's the very first episode of Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist. It ran on Comedy Central for years in the mid-90s. It celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. Jonathan Katz is no therapist, but the Emmy Award-winning comedian cannot escape his credentials from that animated show, which he has brought to a live stage, recorded for a new album called Dr. Katz Live. The real-life Jonathan Katz, we learn, not too surprisingly, is not all fuzzy and animated.
No, I'm a real guy.
You're a real guy.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen a therapist, but I'm not a therapist. I'm a comedian. But I've been in and out of therapy all my life. That's just... And I kind of believe in the work they do, even though the cynical side of me says it's the greatest scam of all time, therapy, because nobody really gets better. But there are people in Newton, where I live, in Newton, Massachusetts, who still think I'm a therapist. And I finally have stopped denying it and just start prescribing.
You're really outing yourself, though, in this live show. I mean, you can't hide behind the animated artists, right?
Right. Or just me out there, my voice. You know, what's wonderful about the CD is that I, too, am in therapy with my therapist, who's portrayed by Tom Snyder, the co-creator of the show. So I get to talk about my own problems, and most of them appear in the form of jokes. Although he pushes me, my make-believe therapist.
This comes up every session, Ben.
Right.
And I'm wondering if we have, you know, if it's about his self-confidence, because that's what I'm, every area of his life he seems to...
I don't think that's the issue. I really don't. I think, you know, I think if anything, he's a kid with too much confidence.
Really?
You know, I remember when he was little, he truly believed that only he could prevent forest fires. And that, maybe that's a lot for a kid to carry around.
Yeah. But
who is the audience for this show?
Well, the audience for the animated show, oddly enough, was teenagers who were in high school watching the show with their parents occasionally. And I guess now, in the year 2014, a lot of those kids who watch the show are now parents. Like, my daughter has a couple of kids.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I was astounded to realize, you know, how long ago that show was on the air. I mean...
Yeah, 20 years.
That's nuts. I hate learning stuff like that.
Well, that's why I didn't bring up the fact that I was a grandfather, because it makes everyone else feel old.
Do you think quite seriously that this live show in many ways is an homage to just what a pioneer and a huge force in comedy that you've been since the 90s? I mean, you know, Ray Romano, Louis C.K. were, you know, big, you know, stars on your show. They talk about you as being mentored by you. I mean, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I really like that. I think it was John Benjamin who is this amazing voiceover actor who has a show called Archer, another one called Bob's Burgers that he stars in.
Yeah, he's huge.
And he's the guy who taught me that I'm allowed to enjoy the time I spend working. Because as a stand-up, which I did for 15 years before Dr. Katz, I did my act almost verbatim. I was like stuck in a one-man show. And then once I met John Benjamin, I realized how much fun it could be going off script and improvising.
Jonathan Katz is an Emmy Award-winning comedian and creator of Dr. Katz Professional Therapist. He's now dropped a new album reprising that role for the show's 20th anniversary. He was a legend in his prime, probably more famous than actor Jason Robards, who played him in the movie about an event he was at the center of just a few years before Hollywood made All the President's Men.
How much can you tell me about Deep Throat?
How much do you need to know?
You trust him?
Yeah.
I can't do the reporting for my reporters, which means I have to trust them. And I hate trusting anybody. Run that, baby.
Jason Robards as Washington Post editor Ben Bradley in the middle of Watergate. Probably no other man quite embodied the power of the press in modern times. No Charles Foster Kane megalomaniac. Bradley was a tough, scrappy individual, high school baseball player who overcame polio and went to Harvard College, worked himself up from humble jobs in the Navy, government, and journalism, faced down presidents as editor of the Washington Post, who trusted his reporters by instinct, instincts that could fail him, but rarely did. He lived and participated in the biggest changes in Washington, D.C. in our time. Jeff Himmelman is the author of Yours in Truth, A Personal Portrait of Ben Bradley. Jeff, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
As editor of The Post, what did he do to change the tone of The Washington Post pre-Watergate?
You know, it's almost amazing. As soon as he came to The Post, and if you go through his archives, which I spent 4 years doing, the change is almost unbelievable. As soon as he gets to The Post in 1965 as a managing editor, the first thing he wants to do is to take the tilt out of the newspaper coverage. So the Post at the time was sort of a left-leaning paper. It was very supportive of LBJ's efforts in Vietnam, et cetera. And the first thing he wanted to do was get what he called the tilt out of the prose. So you could write well, you could write in a lively way, but he didn't want to see the editorial hand behind any of the news pieces, and he was incredibly rigorous about that. The flip side of that coin is that he also became increasingly uncomfortable with the paper's coziness with the Washington establishment, which is something he had been a part of just a few years before. But once he took over the Post, I think he had a sense that the Post could be a real instrument for sort of social good, and I think that became the mission of his life, and I think everything that followed came from that sort of initial conversion.
And here he is talking to us, in a sense, about precisely that. Back in 1995, in an interview with WNYC.
I'm the bane of my liberal friends. I am not a passionate liberal. I've always been much more interested in what the story is, and then let somebody else decide whether it's good or bad.
The story is what mattered, and that's really the set of values that determined how the Watergate story unfolded.
That's absolutely right. And he couldn't, you know, during Watergate, they always tarred him as, you know, a Kennedy coat holder and this and that. And, you know, he had set himself up for that by doing what he had done. But the real truth about Ben, and nobody ever believes it, particularly because of Watergate, but the real truth about Ben is that he wasn't a partisan. He really did just care about the story. If it was a good story, if it was about his next door neighbor, he would take it right to that next door neighbor. He didn't care. He just wanted to see where it would go. That was what mattered to him, is where is this going to go and how can we get the best crack at the truth? And that really was how he operated. It's not a myth. It's the reality.
And one place that story went, Watergate, is that it you know, launched his profile to a place that he was really not terribly comfortable with. Here he is again speaking in 1995.
I violated what my predecessor's number one rule was stay off the stage, stay in the audience. And yet, thanks to Richard Nixon, I couldn't.
Nixon confronted Bradley on the Pentagon Papers, on Watergate, and he suddenly was the story, and he didn't like it at all.
That's right. I mean, I think with Ben, there's a little bit of, you know, he became this sort of larger-than-life figure, particularly after Jason Robards played him in All the President's Men, which came out in 1976. I think, you know, sure, he didn't like it. I think it did interfere with the way he did his job, but there's also a part of Ben that is kind of naturally a celebrity. He's the most charismatic man I've ever met. I think there are a lot of people who share that opinion of him. And I think in some ways he wore it well. And I think at some moments maybe he protested a little too much. But I do think that, you know, his life changed after 1976. He was a celebrity newspaper editor in addition to being a newspaper editor. And that does make your job more difficult to do. And I think he was at times not so pleased with that.
I asked him one time, what's it like to have Jason Robards having played you? Jason Robards being a legend, you certainly being a legend in a quite different field. And he just, you know, he really kind of scratched his head and said, I can't make head nor tails of it.
Right. No, and there's this wonderful story that Kay Graham told, which I have in my book, which I had never seen anywhere else, which was when they went, Alan Pakula, who was the director of the film, they had a private screening for the Post executives about a month before the actual official premiere at the Kennedy Center. And all the Post executives were there, and Ben was sitting, they all sat sort of staggered so that they wouldn't have to be sitting right next to each other if they reacted negatively to what the film was. And there's a certain scene toward the end of the film where, you know, Robards as Ben is about to scream at the reporters for not having the proper sources and whatnot. And Robards is sitting back in his chair with his hands clasped behind his head. And at that moment, Kay Graham looked over at Ben, and Ben was sitting in exactly the same way as Robards was. And he took his hands down and kind of looked around, because he didn't want to be sitting in exactly the same way that Robards was. And he has always located those moments as the moments where he realized that his life was going to change.
Well, you know, Jason Robards, there are certainly worse actors who can play you, that's for sure.
Oh, I mean, he nailed it. I mean, in some ways, he even underplayed it.
Here's Bradley talking about his confrontation in the Supreme Court over the Pentagon Papers and just how dramatic a moment that is.
I mean, there's nothing that'll make you grow faster than you know, a trip to the Supreme Court where the stakes are so high, or an episode like Watergate where if you're wrong, you're dead, you're through, you go into the history books as a fool.
All those moments. Nevertheless, he and his wife Sally Quinn seem to me to be the most comfortable people in Washington. Whatever they might have thought of the Washington scene, this was their world, and they owned it.
That's right. And so Ben and Sally got together during Watergate, and Sally was really a fixture at the paper. She was one of the most important writers there. And, you know, as the 70s turned into the 80s, Ben was less of a day-to-day hard-nosed editor of the paper than he was kind of this sort of incredible eminence there. And it was his paper, even though certainly by the mid-80s, the people below him, in particular Len Downey and Bob Kaiser, were really running the paper. And so I think as the 70s turned into the 80s, Ben became this kind of fixture in Washington, but always in a way that was encouraging of younger people, of journalists, always in a way that was true to, I think, his core values, even though they became this kind of, you know, a sort of prototypical power couple. I think, you know, when people came to that house for their big parties at various times, and I have been to a couple of them, just to be in his presence there was enough for a lot of people.
Did his instincts about mentoring fail him in the Janet Cook story?
You know, a lot of things failed in the Janet Cook story. You can't take Ben off the hook, but the whole chain failed. The fact that they allowed her to have anonymous sources and all this, there's kind of overtones of Watergate to it all. And Woodward was the Metro editor at the time, and he was directly responsible for the story. And it bit him, and he had to pay for it. But if I could just say one more quick thing, I think Ben's response to the Janet Cook episode, to my mind, tells you more about Ben even than Watergate does, because he was wrong. His tried and true methodology failed him. And in that moment, he made the decision that the Washington Post would publish every single aspect of how that story had gone wrong before anybody else could, that they would just take their lumps and he would go out there and apologize and do what he could to tell the truth. And that saved him. And he had learned from Nixon, it's the cover-up that gets you. And I think that's one of the most remarkable parts of who Ben is that often gets lost in the shuffle of the Pentagon Papers and Watergate.
Jeff Himmelman, author of Yours in Truth, A Personal Portrait of Ben Bradley. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Remembering the rich, full life of Ben Bradley, fought many good fights, learned from the victories and defeats, and stayed generous and content through it all. Tomorrow, how to beat the billionaires using money and crowdsourcing to combat the distortions of super PACs by matching reform-minded candidates with passionate small givers. Powering up the people by powering down the billionaires. That's next time on The Takeaway. Thanks for listening. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.